This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. This afternoon, we're going to be talking about two books of historical interest in a totally different way. First one is political and is probably going to be very much in the news in the next couple of months. The other is more abstract, having to do with scientific history. The second one is The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments by George Johnson. We'll talk about that in the second half of the program. The book we've got in the first half of the program is The Boys from Dolores, Fidel Castro's Schoolmates from Revolution to Exile by Patrick Sims. And we have Patrick on the line right now. Welcome to Booktown.
Thank you, Eric.
It was just 50 years ago that people really became very conscious of the Cuban Revolution, that It was a very well-publicized revolution. Fidel Castro and his men were holed up in the Sierra Maestra Mountains in eastern Cuba, but it seemed that they had one of the best public relations machines going, and by the time they took power on the 1st of January in 1959, everybody was anticipating something very important happening. Apparently, the whole story goes back much farther than that, and involves many of the people that Castro went to school with at the Colegio Dolores in Santiago. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, my idea in The Boys from Dolores was to go back to youth and find out the sort of the origin points of this incredible, what seems to us to have been a very sudden appearance, this dramatic revolution. Why did it happen? Where did it come from? And of course, in asking about that and asking about the origins, where Castro came from, what happened to the boys around him, what I'm ultimately getting at is what's going to happen to Cuba after Castro, because he's been this great anomaly. There was a world before him, and that his world is slowly coming to a close now. Things are changing in Cuba, and we're going to have to postulate a lot about what are the next 5 years hold, the next 10 years, and I think the best way to do that is to look back to the 1950s, 40s, and even 30s, when Castro was just a kid laying down his ideas, making these alliances, and sort of discovering who he was in the world. It is a case where the personality of one man just ended up having a tremendous effect on the course of history of that island in the Caribbean and the United States.
Most Americans think of Fidel Castro as a dedicated communist, an ally of the Soviet Union, and so on, but he grew up in a great privilege and went to the best school, the best private school in eastern Cuba.
And that's right. And his father was someone who was really a self-made man who made a lot of money, made a great fortune in Cuba. So young Fidel grew up in the middle of the sugarcane business that was totally dominated by Americans. He grew up in the countryside where literally all the land around him was owned by United Fruit. And he was part of he had access to that elite part of Cuban society, went to this Jesuit school, the Colegio Dolores in eastern Cuba, and met many of the young heirs to influential families. The Bacardis were students at the Colegio Dolores, that's a name that may ring a bell. And many other boys from Desi Arnaz up through, you know, I tracked down what happened to the old baseball companions of Fidel's, the basketball star, the guy he was, you know, engaged in a lot of his sort of rigorous academic studies with, and sort of tracking them down and looking at their lives was, of course, a window into the whole history of Cuba over these decades, and they were literally witnesses to this history being made.
I guess at the Colegio Dolores, Fidel was one of the outstanding students and athletes.
Yeah, he was outstanding in almost every way. A really well-rounded kid, perceived at that time, by the age of 13, 14, 15, as an up-and-comer, a favorite student of these very rigorous Jesuit instructors, a leader of many of the extracurricular activities, the star left-handed pitcher of the baseball team. Very ambitious. By the time he was, by his own account, Castro said, you know, by the age of 9, he had sort of taken responsibility for his own education and decided that he needed to make his own way in the world and was, you know, going to be, by according to his friends at the Dolores school, he, by the age of 13, was talking about stepping up to be the leader of Cuba someday. So he had a big imagination, a big appetite for even domineering and dominance within the school. His younger brother, Raul, was also a student there, and Raul was the one who was much more of a communist and a believer from a young age that this, the revolution of socialism, was the future, unlike Fidel, who flirted with different ideologies, but ultimately, I think, was a Cuban nationalist, somebody whose real concern was his own power. When he came to Havana in 1959, he started building his revolution and did just as never tried to share power with anybody.
You mentioned that although he was an outstanding student and athlete, he was never particularly popular, never had very many close friends among the other students.
Well, that's true, and I think from what I heard, you know, talking to this whole group of boys who were all around him in the school photos from back in those days, you know, I went and looked them up, some in New York, some in Cuba, some in Miami. Fidel didn't really tolerate anybody being his equal. He wanted to be a big fish, and Dolores was a pretty small pond, 238 boys in the school, and Fidel really wanted to be the top student, and when he couldn't, necessarily, he was a great student, he was one of the top students, but he had certain rivals, and those boys would tell me, you know, it was a very hard to sort of be on his side because he viewed everyone as a potential rival. So he was more interested in being number one than in sharing anything, even the credit for a sports victory or a, you know, an academic title. I heard so many stories about how competitive he was, really driven to be the top fish in that pond. And indeed, that he ended up leaving the school after a fist fight with a fellow who was one of his closest friends and rivals. You know, they got in a stickball game, they got in an altercation, and started knocking each other down. And according to this fellow who lives in New York City, he knocked Fidel down. And after that, you know, in front of all these boys, and it was a terrible humiliation for the supposedly greatest boy in the school to be knocked down. And Fidel never really could tolerate that. And he left Dolores after that because he wanted to transfer to a bigger, more prestigious school off in Havana and have a new beginning with boys who had never seen him, you know, humiliated physically like that.
But he did go on with some of the students from Dolores, went on to the University of Havana, went on to law school with him, and he was close to a number of them for a few years. None of them ever really took an active, or none of them took a major role in the revolution, however.
That's right. Many of them, you know, this was an elite school. Many of these boys were from landowning families or prominent business families. You know, I think at least 90% of Cubans supported the revolution initially, and indeed even among the wealthier classes that was true, and some of these boys did play small roles in the revolution, including, you know, a fellow who became a dentist. He was the basketball star, became a dentist, and he was one of Castro's top treasurer during the course of the revolution, a very dangerous job. He was arrested, had a gun pressed to his head, barely escaped with his life. And yet they all very quickly kind of soured on the revolution because one of the first things Fidel did when coming to power was start to take away the privileges and the possessions of his own class. The people who were in the middle class, the upper class in Cuba, started seeing nationalizations. And so a lot of these fellows turned against him very quickly, and a few even participated in anti-Castro activities, you know, attacking their old high school buddy in speedboats and so on.
Although you do also point out that this was very definitely a revolution of the privileged, or at least of the middle class, that it could never have come from the really oppressed workers, many of whom were black, and many of whom were illiterate.
It's an interesting insight because it ended up being a revolution of the black and the poor and the poorest within Cuba, the illiterates and so on, who were the ones at the very bottom of the society. But it wasn't quite made that way, and I owe that insight to the main character in my book, a fellow named Lundy Aguilar, who was a professor at Georgetown University for 30 years, and indeed was Bill Clinton's favorite professor. He taught history, European history, Cuban history. And he argued in his scholarly papers that, you know, if you look at who made the revolution, the leading figures were often drawn from the people like Castro, who was a young lawyer. These were often financed by the wealthy in Cuba, and it was really the aspiring middle class that was very frustrated with the era of corruption, the era of American dominance, in which a Cuban engineer could never get the good job. It always went to an American engineer. And so there was this set of people who expected, wanted the promise of democracy, but didn't feel they were getting it under this corrupt government in the 1940s and 50s. And Castro sort of led them in making this great revolution. Of course, the poor participated, but the really crucial roles in the leadership came from Cuba's own leadership class.
You describe Aguilar as the best educated person you've ever met, and that's certainly a tribute to the education he got at the Colegio Dolores. But he didn't stay in Cuba long after the revolution, and many of the Dolorinos left within just a few years.
Yeah, it's true. The year I focus on is 1961, which is really the year the exodus from Cuba began, and it wasn't just the boys from Dolores, of course, but about 100,000 Cubans left that year as the big nationalizations kicked in. You know, the boys from Dolores, there were all types of boys at that school, not just the wealthy or the well-educated. I had a wonderful interview in Puerto Rico with a guy named Alberto Casas, who was kind of a class troublemaker in Fidel's day, and just a kind of a proud numbskull. He was a really kind of macho guy, a cattle baron, a farmer, a really tough, uncouth man. And he was the first one to flee. He never went to university. He didn't have any sense of history. He just knew Fidel, and he said, "I don't trust him," and he left immediately and went to Puerto Rico. He died recently. So did Lindy Aguilar. This generation, as we see with Fidel himself, is fading away, and that was always a problem for me as I worked, because one by one, my sources have been drying up.
Now, you put a lot of emphasis in the book on Fidel's competitiveness, his need to be number one, and you attribute a lot of the authoritarianism that developed after the revolution to that. The other main factor that a lot of people pay attention or draw attention to is the immediate or almost immediate American hostility to the revolution. I mean, middle-class kids like I was in high school in 1959 thought this was a very cool thing, but pretty quickly the American government turned fiercely anti-Castro. Do you think that had something to do with the authoritarianism that developed?
I think it had to do with Fidel's decision to sort of seek comfort in the arms of the Soviet Union. I think, a revolution always eats its children, and the desire for control and authority and power, it's not just Fidel who had that. It's not the United States that gave it to him. That's a strong tradition in Cuba and many Latin American nations. Strong men are always popular, and the man riding in on the horse like Castro, riding in on his tank to announced we were going to have a new golden age of Cuban history. That's always popular. So the desire to control and to eliminate all rivals within Cuba, to eliminate parties, to build really what is a dictatorship, I don't think that's particularly the result of United States hostility. It's undoubtable, however, the U.S. hostility played a big role in pushing Cuba to seek a patron elsewhere. I think if we'd ignored Castro to death, he might have been a milder dictator, but he still would have been a dictator.
But now that's pretty much come to an end. He's in bad health. He's relinquished his power. His younger brother, Raul, has taken over, and things seem to be beginning to loosen up there. Although you thought of Raul as being, on the one hand, a more dedicated communist than Fidel, but on the other hand, much more colorless and much less forceful.
Yeah, he is a big advocate of kind of the tough hand, the You know, he's the one who built up the military intelligence, the secret police in Cuba, all the institutes of arms of repression within Cuba, the jail system, I think he's administered for 50 years now. So he's a tough hombre. Maybe because of that, he's much more the administrator than Fidel. Fidel was the great leader and visionary speaker, could talk for 6 hours at a time. Raul doesn't say much at all. So maybe precisely because he has a hardline reputation, there's a little room for him to do some cosmetic changes, you know, letting people have easier access to buying cell phones or letting people visit the beaches that were exclusively for foreigners and so on. So these are actually very small changes. I don't think it's as revolutionary as some people say, but on the other hand, it's just a beginning. So it is a change. It is a sign that Raul may have, as his, some of his defenders have said, you know, he lives in a relatively modest house in a fairly ordinary neighborhood of Havana. It's still a nice house, but he drives through the decrepit city every day on his way to work. Fidel has been living for a decade or two in, you know, a big mansion in the outskirts of Cuba and riding in a motorcade to work until he fell ill, you know, that would pass up the nicest avenue in Havana. So some people have told me, oh, well, Raul, at least he really sees what's going on in the country. He's a better administrator. Maybe there's a chance for reforms there, but I do think he's also an authoritarian, is trying to consolidate and control the society and maybe give an inch because he has to.
Among the Dolorinos you mentioned, there's one set of there's several sets of brothers, including the Castros, Bacardis, and so on. But there's also the, I don't know how they pronounce it in Spanish, the De Jongs.
The De Jongs.
De Jongs now, who were originally Dutch Jewish family who had settled in Cuba and rose to prominence. But they split. That some of them went to the U.S. and one stayed in Cuba.
Yes, it was fascinating. I knew from my experience in Cuba that somewhere I would find this. And, it, you know, every institution in Cuba was divided by the revolution. Even the school, the Colegio Dolores, was divided. So of course, families were divided. And I knew sooner or later I would find somebody like this. And these were three brothers who, you know, the oldest one, David, was a classmate of Fidel's, knew him very well. Became a surgeon, fled to the United States. The youngest one, you know, there was a middle brother who eventually went to the United States as well, but the youngest one stayed behind, an architect named Kiki DeYoung, and he is to this day a sort of intellectual defender of the necessity of the Cuban Revolution, who really challenged, you know, his brothers and their decision to go abroad and said, well, you know, he told me, well, of course there were people like us, people from the elite, people with money. Yeah, we lost a lot in the revolution, but it was still worth it because of the independence it gave Cuba, the social transformation that was necessary. You know, he really kind of threw my questions back in my face in a very interesting way and forced me to acknowledge that even though I think the revolution was a failure in the end. If you look at Cuba today, it may have started out as this great social transformation, but produced a lot of chaos and ruins and economic destitution, all of which were exacerbated by U.S. policies. But the revolution, you know, has its own serious problems. But you can't speak of that without acknowledging the serious successes, the massive literacy campaigns, the fact that every Cuban has a doctor. These are revolutionary developments in Cuban society, anywhere in the Caribbean or in Latin America, which is why even now Cuba still has such a hold on people, especially in Latin America. It's this land of hope for the poor.
In the future, some people predict that Cuba will just, after a certain amount of muddle, will become essentially a U.S. satellite again, the way it was under Batista. Do you see that as a possibility? Do you see it as any return to the sort of society that once produced the Colegio Dolores?
Yeah, I worry that that could be true. I mean, it's certainly a potential scenario with massive American financial investment in Cuba, likely, you know, if there's a change of government. You know, Cuban Americans are eager to do business in Cuba. I think that business changes are already taking over Cuba. So it's not impossible that the United States will again kind of get control of Cuba. I think that would be actually against the interests of the United States in the long run. Cuba's a very patriotic society, deeply nationalistic. About the only thing that Cubans agree on is love of their country, and that desire for independence is so fundamental. It's a defining quality in Cuba. They fought for centuries to shake off Spanish rule. Then the United States came in and replaced the Spaniards in some way. So that was the real source of Castro's revolution, was a frustration that, you know, the victories of Cuban independence had been sort of stymied or set aside by U.S. influence, and I don't think they'll really tolerate that again, even though many Cubans are wildly pro-American in their attitudes in the streets. And when you talk to people, they love America. They have, you know, family in America. They see America as a land of economic opportunity, but also of democracy and the rule of law. So there are many people who say, yes, we want to be learn some lessons from America.
The other possibility would be just another homegrown oligarchy, as occurred in so many other Latin American countries. You think that might be possible?
Sure. The military and the Communist Party in Cuba are both very strong organizations. 7% of Cubans are in the party. They're preparing now to do whatever it takes to hold on to power. I think right now what's missing from the equation of Cuban politics is money. There is no money on the island. No one makes any money. No one's allowed to have any money. It's a society almost without financial capabilities. So what happens when, you know, Cuba has offshore oil fields that they're auctioning off? Someday those will be developed and actually start pumping oil, and large amounts of money will come in. If an embargo is lifted and investment flows in from all over the world, the United States, you know, corruption could come in. Dissidents I've talked to in Havana, like Osvaldo Paya, one of the most important political opposition figures in Havana, said he's very worried about, you know, the desire for revenge, the arrival of drugs and guns that could really transform what's been a society in a kind of cultural lockdown for half a century now. Cuba may be a police state, but there's a lot of day-to-day security for ordinary people in a police state, and I think they're going to enter a very new, scary world once the changes become deeper and more profound.
Do you have any final prediction of all these possibilities, which way you think it might go?
Predictions are very dangerous when it comes to Cuba, but I do think that what we're going to see most likely is a slow, steady, very slow transition, perhaps a decade or more, perhaps extending long beyond the lifespan of Raul Castro, let alone Fidel Castro. This might be just the beginning of a process that could play out over 10 years or more, where, you know, I think the powers that be in Cuba will struggle, perhaps successfully, to hold on to their power, whether that means the military or the Communist Party or an enriched by corruption group of interests. But I do think, we're not going to see an overnight explosion of, you know, people's power in the streets. I've talked to dissidents all over the island, and they're under very close scrutiny, and can hardly get five people together in a living room to have a discussion before the police show up. So there's not much chance for a sudden overthrow of the system.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Patrick Sims, the author of The Boys from Dolores, Fidel Castro's Schoolmates from Revolution to Exile. It's just come out in paperback. It came out in hardback about a year ago, just come out in paperback from Vintage Books. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be here till 2 p.m. In the second half of the program, I'm going to be talking with George Johnson, a science reporter for the New York Times and other publications, about his most recent book, The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments. Welcome to Booktown, George Johnson.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
This is a fascinating topic because one of the things that I think particularly characterizes Western science and mathematics is the quest for elegance, for doing everything in the most economical, most efficient, and I guess you'd say most beautiful way.
Yes, it's almost like a classical Greek beauty, the golden mean.
And
everything well proportioned, including the logic.
And you obviously chose the 10 experiments from all of science, mostly in the last 400 years.
Yeah, but starting back with Galileo, and so, of course, anytime you choose 10 most beautiful experiments, there's a certain amount of subjectivity and just artifice involved in coming up with the list, but I just decided I'd come up with my own personal favorite 10.
Because I guess before that, you reported in the Times back in 2002 about another list of the 10 most beautiful physical experiments.
Yes, that's how this all really started, and I got such good response to that article, and my editor at Knopf said, a book about the 10 most beautiful experiments would be really an interesting endeavor, and I wanted to spread my scope out beyond just physics and try to come up with an account of 10 moments in the history of science that were really pivotal.
And as it turns out, only about 4 of yours are the same as the ones from that original list.
I hadn't actually compared them directly, so it's good to hear that there's not too much overlap.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some that you would have to include, like Newton's beautiful experiment with the prism.
So when you sat down, you didn't actually, you probably had that other list somewhere in the back of your mind, but you essentially started from scratch.
I started from scratch, and I think the earliest experiment in that original list was the Greek Greek philosopher, natural scientist who measured the circumference of the Earth?
I never know how to pronounce it. Eratosthenes.
Yeah, Eratosthenes. And that didn't strike me as so much as an experiment as a brilliant observation. He made came up with this great way to measure the circumference of the Earth depending on the angle of sunlight and the length of shadows. But actually, there was no way to check to see if he was right. Although it turns out that we know now that he was astonishingly close. But in that sense, it wasn't so much an experiment. I was looking more for cases where one person, like a single mind confronting the unknown by coming up with a tabletop apparatus that poses a question to nature and then just waiting to receive a reply.
And I guess my observation from trying to look at the history of science and math around the world is that so many of the great technical innovations came from China, and so much of the mathematical innovation after the Greeks came from India and the Islamic world.
Yeah, that's true.
But it was only in the 16th century that Europeans began to put all this together.
Yes, and they were so many of the great experimenters were European. And just from that era, there was Newton, and then going beyond Newton in chemistry in France, we had Lavoisier, and who essentially discovered the nature of chemical combustion and what fire really was.
So you start with Galileo, and actually in the original physical experiments, there are 2 experiments of his, but I think you sort of discount one, the idea that he had dropped 2 weights from the Tower of Pisa.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's what I'd always learned in school, that he dropped a cannonball and the equivalent of a golf ball, whatever they had back then to show that they actually hit the ground at the same time. And Aristotle would have said that a weight 100 times more massive than another weight would fall 100 times more quickly. And I don't know, I think by Galileo's time, people must have noticed that wasn't true, but there was still a real question of what the nature of motion in free fall was.
But the experiment that you actually do include is the one about measuring the velocity of a falling object or of a moving
object. Yeah, so the velocity of a ball rolling down an inclined plane, and the brilliant stroke there was that it slows the experiment down enough where you can actually make precise measurements. And, you know, I think people assumed that things would go faster and faster as they, you know, rolled down the hill because you could, you know, observe that. And Galileo wanted to find out the exact mathematical proportion by which that happened, and then came up with his famous time squared law.
The descent increases by the square of the amount of time that's passed.
Yeah, right. So, you know, after 2 seconds, it's gone 4 times the distance. After 3 seconds, 9, and then 16 and 25. And to do that, Galileo had to do some very precise timing, and historians were skeptical for a long time that he could really have done the experiment with the limited technology back then. I mean, there weren't any clocks. He described using a water clock, you know, basically like an hourglass where you measure time by water dripping out of a container, and then you weigh the water to see how much time has passed. But people could demonstrate the time squared law with that rather crude timekeeping mechanism, but it didn't seem plausible to a lot of people that he could have actually originally measured time that way.
And you think it was only in the last 30 years that it was actually discovered how he really did it?
Yeah, and it's still speculation, but the great Galileo scholar Stillman Drake thought, well, the one way you could time objects or time motion that precisely in any era would have been with music, because people with a natural music sense and a sense of rhythm can actually distinguish between split-second differences in time. The example Drake gave was if you're listening to an orchestra and, say, a cymbal or a timpani comes in, you know, a 16th note beat too late, and, you know, a great deal of the audience will notice that something's a little off. They might not be able to put their finger on it, but they're actually, you know, they're actually able to make these kinds of distinctions. So he imagines that Galileo's rolling the ball down the long inclined plane and then using music, like the beat of the music, to time the descent.
And by going through these, the numbers that Galileo wrote down, and he figured out that that's probably exactly what he had done.
Yeah, that was the hint, because Drake actually found Galileo's lab notebook in his data. People hadn't seen it before, but they didn't know what it was because the pages were out of order, and somehow it hit Drake that this looked like data that would roughly, not roughly, but very closely demonstrate the time squared law, and he set up an apparatus as Galileo described and repeated the experiment himself and showed that he could basically demonstrate the time squared law and get data very much like Galileo's by doing the experiment with music. So I just thought that was wonderful to think of Galileo singing as the ball rolls down the inclined plane.
Now, most of the experiments that have to do with physics or chemistry are very dependent on mathematics, as that first one would have been. I think the two that aren't particularly are William Harvey's discovery of circulation in the blood, and then Pavlov's work on conditioned reflexes.
Right, right. That's true. And with Harvey, it's a much more qualitative observations, although he did do this great calculation where, I mean, for context, the prevailing belief back then was that the blood went back and forth in the blood system. They didn't call it the circulatory system because they didn't think that blood circulated, and that there was the blue blood system and there was the red blood system, and that they were pretty much separate. So another part of the prevailing belief was that blood was constantly generated in the liver and constantly consumed by the body, just, you know, from motion and growth. And Harvey decided to do the math, and from some from animal experiments, he knew basically, you know, what a plausible amount of blood was that came out of the heart with each beat, and then he added up the number of beats in an hour, and, you know, just realized that, you know, if the blood was, you know, constantly being manufactured in the body, there would just be vastly more blood than he had already known would be in a single body if you drained it out and measured it. So we figured somehow the blood was probably being reused or recycled.
And he also noticed that the color of the blood would change.
Right, right. Yeah, the Galenists, who were the followers of Galen, who believed that blood went back and forth, just thought that, you know, well, there's blue blood and there's red blood, and then it took Harvey to realize that they were connected, right, and that the blue blood was spent red blood returning to the heart to be re-nourished and sent around the circle again.
So many of these experiments really predate the modern group science that we have now. Right toward the end, Robert Millikan, he and his assistant, well, and I guess Pavlov even more, had a whole team of people. But most of these, most of the experiments you find most beautiful were done by individuals, sometimes working for years on their own.
Right, that's what really struck me, because a lot of the science that that I write about involves these large teams of experiments. Like when they discovered, or you know, basically confirmed the existence of a particle called the top quark at Fermi Lab, and I think it was in 1995, there were more than 400 different collaborators on the experiment. So I just, the other day, I called up a copy of the paper on the internet and was looking at it, and you know, it goes on for pages and pages just listing all the co-authors. So I really, you know, felt kind of nostalgic and wanted to revisit the days when it was usually a single person, maybe two people working together, and you know, they didn't have this whole kind of corporation of assistants.
And occasionally two or three people fighting back and forth about what something meant.
Yeah, that's true, like with Luigi Galvani and Alessandro Volta, the two great Italian scientists who learned so much about the nature of electricity by engaging in what amounted to an intellectual duel.
Now, most of the people you mentioned were among the best educated scientists or physicians or mathematicians of their time.
Yeah.
But there are a couple, like Faraday and Joule, who were really rank outsiders, and they were among the greatest contributions.
That's true. And yeah, and Faraday had you know, grown up, you know, very, very poor household, you know, didn't go to all the great schools, and he never was very good at mathematics either, but he just loved to tinker and experiment, and he kind of lucked into a job at the Royal Institution in London, working for Humphrey Davies, who was one of the great scientists of the time, and then went on to make some just astonishing discoveries involving electricity, magnetism, and then electricity, magnetism, and light, showing that they were all related.
And, well, I can't say too much more than that, except he was probably the person who set the whole, he started the whole field of electromagnetism, and then
yeah.
Maxwell systematized it a few years later.
Exactly, right. You know, it all started with Oersted, the Danish scientist who noticed that, you know, if you connect a wire across the terminals of a battery and put it next to a compass, it makes the compass needle move. And when Faraday and Davy heard about that, they were just astonished, and they, you know, replicated it and found out that it was true. Somehow electricity in the wire was sending some sort of invisible waves through space and moving the compass needle. And, you know, it was the next step was Faraday showing that he could take magnets and make them rotate inside a coil of wire, and then, you know, basically inventing the electric motor. And then he showed that the converse is true, where if you spin a magnet around inside a coil of wire, like turn it with a crank, then you generate electricity. So he invented the electrical generator, and you know, the whole technology we use now to generate electricity, you know, all over the world.
The other, I think the experiment that in some ways I find the most fascinating, although you start your chapter about it, talking about it, but you sort of downplay it toward the end, and that was James Joule going to measure the temperature at the top and the bottom of a waterfall on his honeymoon.
Yeah, that's such a great story. And Lord Kelvin was the one who told the story, and he claims that he was hiking in the Alps, and then sees Joule coming down the road carrying this large thermometer, because Joule had a suspicion that heat was a form of motion, and he figured that water at the top of a waterfall would be slightly cooler than the water at the bottom because of the heat generated in the fall. So, again, it's one of those stories that may be apocryphal, but what Jewel did do was this great experiment with a paddle wheel, which he spun around in a brass cylinder using weight, and he could very precisely measure how many foot-pounds of work went into spinning around the paddle wheel, and then he could measure precisely how much the temperature of the water increased. So we basically showed that heat is the mechanical equivalent of work.
Another experiment that is probably one of the foundations of modern physics, I was surprised, was not in the original 2002 list, but you do include it now, and that's the one by Michelson and Morley, measuring the speed of light.
Yeah.
Which other people had been doing for centuries, but they got more and more precise. And along the way, they discovered something rather that shocked everybody.
Yeah, they're basically using their knowledge of light speed to try to measure the motion of the Earth against the backdrop of outer space, or, you know, what was then called the ether, as it was believed that there was this some kind of invisible essence that must pervade space, you know, that space must be made of something, and that the Earth must move against the ether, and in doing so, you would think that a light beam that was sent out with the Earth would be slowed down a little bit by what Michelson called the ether wind, while a light beam that was going crossways, perpendicular, would be not slowed down so much. So they sent light beams traveling in two directions over equal paths, and then brought them back together with mirrors into something called an interferometer, which you'd be able to visually see by an interference pattern if one light beam had traveled at a slightly different speed than the other, and they couldn't find any difference, and they kept wondering what was wrong with the experiment, and they kept refining it, and finally Michelson had to conclude that, you know, there probably isn't any ether, that, you know, the speed of light is the same anywhere in the universe under all circumstances.
And that it was that really was the foundation for Einstein's theories.
Yes, right, and as I understand it, there's a debate as to whether Einstein actually knew of the Michelson-Morley experiment when he devised his theory of special relativity, but when he learned about it, it was, you know, just fit so neatly into what he'd come up with for theoretical reasons. And Michelson and Einstein later met very late in Michelson's life, and I guess it was a very big moment for them both.
In your very short afterword, you mentioned two perhaps omissions. One is that there's no women involved, and the second, what the other experiments were that you had to leave out to come up with just with 10.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of, you know, sit back and, you know, acknowledge that, you know, when you throw down the gauntlet like this and say these are the 10 most beautiful experiments, other people are going to have their own candidates, and that's part of the fun of the book. And I thought a bit about what I might have included, and one of them was the experiment by Marie and Pierre Curie, in which they discovered and isolated the element radium, you know, learning a great deal about radioactivity in the meantime. And I'll see, another possibility would have been, there was a great Chinese-American experimental physicist who was known as Madame Wu, the Dragon Lady, some of her colleagues called her, and she did this brilliant experiment that proved that the weak nuclear force violated something called conservation of parity. But my feeling was, by the time science got to that point, it was starting to be more of this team science rather than individual science, and with many more layers of abstraction involved in interpreting the experiment. So it really seemed that the beautiful experiments, as I defined them, started to, you know, kind of peter out in the early part of the 20th century, which is just the time when women were really becoming, you know, very important as experimental scientists.
Yeah, almost all the other candidates you mention are from before 1920. Rutherford in the nucleus, or the neutron, Chadwick discovering the neutron.
Yeah, Rutherford would have been a natural, you know, where he fired the alpha particle at gold foil, and then showed that, you know, most sailed through, but a few bounced back, and later interpreted that as there being a hard core inside the atom that we now call the nucleus. Also, another reason why some didn't make it and others did was I wanted to have a fair amount of variety. And my final chapter was on Robert Millikan and the discovery of the electron. And I thought, well, maybe I should not have two chapters about particle physics. But I could have easily done Rutherford instead of doing Millikan. So it was just one of those judgments I had to make. So I didn't come up with a book called like the 77 Most Beautiful Experiments.
The 20th century is the century of group physics, but it's also sort of the century, or was the century, of thought experiments.
Right.
Which hadn't really played much of a part before then. I guess suddenly a number of especially leading physicists realized that there were, and I guess they were following somewhat in Einstein's lead, because so much of his work depended on visualizing how things would happen that you couldn't necessarily originally measure mathematically.
Right.
So they came up with thought experiments about what would happen if such and such, such and such and such had happened, that they knew they might never be able to actually empirically verify.
Yeah. What happens if your spaceship sucked into a black hole?
Right.
Right.
And I guess those would never fit into your canon because they're completely unverifiable.
Yeah, they really. Yeah, that's part of it. And also, I really had a prejudice toward experiments that you could perform yourself with just a little bit of practice and training, or at least make an honest attempt. And with fairly available parts, something you could set up on a kitchen table.
And you did try yourself to replicate Millikan's.
Yeah, boy, that's a lot harder than. I mean, I knew it was going to be hard, and I did. I watched it being replicated by a real expert up at St. John's College here in Santa Fe, who'd done it many, many times and had the technique down. But then I tried it again myself at home, and boy, my hat goes off to Robert Millikan. That's a difficult experiment.
And then the question comes up, well, if it's that difficult, how much of it is, might it have been prejudiced by his particular physical abilities?
Yeah.
It did turn out that it was true, and I guess that's the final.
There was a period when some people wondered if Millikan had been very selective in which data he kept and which data that he threw out, because, if that's true, he wasn't making a secret of it. It's all there in his notebooks, and people see little marginalia where he'll say, wow, that was a great run, definitely use this one. Nah, bad one, messed this one up. But I think most scientists who read the notebooks and know the story think that Millikan was doing what scientists do all the time, that you develop kind of an intuitive sense for your equipment and when an experiment goes right and when just random factors cause it to go awry. But of course, the danger is always where you draw the line between those subjective interpretations and starting to see what you want to see instead of what's really there.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I've been talking with George Johnson, the author of The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments, that was recently published by Knopf. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much. Enjoyed it.
Stay tuned now for Jimmy Icardi's Rock and Roll Party.